would be great. We were discussing paragraph 51 of your email, and I would like to stay on that for a few minutes. In addition to the other matters on your list, we have the tool should be repeatable, i.e. different people will get the same results, and E, consistent over time. Those are relatively well understood. Well, would you add to that, and I think you've commented on farms on regional boundaries, a criterion on national consistency?
I think that would be helpful for the regulator party if it may be differently applied across different parts of the motu, depending on whether or not where you want people to be regulated through permitted, controlled, or discretionary. But a tool that is able to be used across different catchments would seem to be beneficial for a regulator party here.
Although the first part of your answer was, although the percentiles chosen might be different if you're using the percentiles.
So I think what your question is around the tool that would use for gateways, as opposed to whether or not the criteria that's used in the Waikato for low, medium, and high would be the same. Of course, that's something that would be specific to the particular outcomes that one is looking to achieve in different catchments. There may be. So if that makes sense, that the tool would be useful, but where you apply those numbers may be very, very different. Again, I'm straying into policy merits again, so I should stay away from that.
No, that's useful. That's what I understood your answer to be. In terms of straying into policy merits again, your evidence doesn't cover, does it, the second use of the tool, as I've referred to, what you have to do when you get through the consent gateway. Your evidence doesn't cover that in relation to the tool, or does it?
No, it doesn't. Ask your question and I'll tell you whether or not.
All I wanted to know was whether you've covered that, and that was my understanding that you're not commenting on that. On the first day of the hearing, I tabled an exhibit which was accepted by consent and by the parties, and it's the Ministry for the Environment letter to the Chief Executive of the Horizon Regional Council and Waikato Regional Council. Now, have you had any knowledge of the offer by the Ministry for the Environment to assist the Regional Council with assessing the different tolls as contained in this letter?
If you could provide me a copy of the letter. I'm aware of that generality. Mm. I'm aware that there's a work program around this tool, where the Ministry is supporting a bunch of experts getting together to try to figure something out, so I'm aware of that it's ongoing, and every now and then I get an update of are they making progress or not, but the person that would be the best person to ask from the council about that was Mr. Scarsbrook, because he's involved with the detail.
Yes, well, I've missed that opportunity, so that's all right. Thank you. I won't pursue that any further. If I can turn, please, to paragraph 56 of your evidence.
Sorry, I can't hear that.
Paragraph 56.
56. Yes.
So this discusses policy 7 of the decisions version of the plan, which stated that generally not granting resource consent that authorise farming and commercial vegetable production activities for a duration beyond 2035. In recognition of the possibility that a replacement regional plan may include new requirements for management after that date, including an allocation regime. And my understanding of your evidence is that you support deleting the threshold of 2035 in favour of the words not granting for a duration exceeding 15 years.
Correct.
And you were here when Mr. McAuliffe provided evidence on Monday and provided evidence on what the freshwater plan review will do, including looking at visions, values, attributes, dates for values, potentially new rules to provide limits for those attribute states. You understand the import of all that evidence?
I understand. I was here and I heard the evidence. Your second part is I understand the import of it all. I believe so.
Alright, well, I'll get on to my next question. So, with the requirement of Plan Change 1 to submit a resource consent application for some subcatchments within 12 months after it gets made operative, for some catchments 2 years, etc., that goes out to 5 years after Plan Change 1 becomes operative, is that right?
Yes, I believe so.
So, now I'll say Plan Change 1 becomes operative, I'll say 2025, which is slightly pessimistic, but you'll be expecting consent applications up until 2030, if that's the case. Yes.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So a 15-year consent term would mean that you would have consents lasting until potentially 2045.
I don't quite read it the same way that you're reading it. So I'm reading it saying up to, and so, and that generally shorter terms as subsequent plan changes approach. How I read this is it provides flexibility so that we don't end up in a position. This plan change has taken a decade. From an implementation perspective, it would be beneficial. Again, I make the comment that I'm coming from an implementer's perspective, and I know there's only one element of this, and so that's not going to need to be weighed up with other policy nuances. But from an implementer's perspective, acknowledging that Plan Change 1 was the first step in a multi-step process to give effect to 25 minutes, that if consents are put in place, it would be appropriate to enable those consents to be exercised. The impact on what will hopefully be progress towards the 20% improvement that is being sought through the first step in a long step process, that information comes to forth so that the next iteration of the plan change can then be put in place to see what the next step on that journey is. And the next round of consenting is done taking into account that new, that whatever policy direction comes. And so my simple maths was every 10 years you have to review the plan. Hopefully it takes half as long next time as the 10 years that it's taken this time. That gets down to 15 as the maximum. So hopefully by then we'll be in a position to be going through a new consenting process. That was the maths that was done. So if I think I understand what you're saying, is that if the freshwater plans that come through, all the plans that come through from under the NBEA, which you'll know the time that when that becomes operative in the Waikato region, we're a bit down the chain on that. And from an implementation perspective, you have the new policy framework in place to determine new consent processes so that you're not doing them under the same policy that exists now. So it says up to enable that, and then shorter as those new policies are looking like to come into place. So that's the background, and from an implementation perspective, I stand by that.
All right, I heard your answers to Ms. Carruthers about the non-complying activity rule 3.11.4.9 and that it's important to hold the line with that non-complying activity rule. I just want to put to you a scenario that may occur under this policy 7 without a line being drawn of a cut-off date. Don't you anticipate that on a case-by-case basis, because consent terms will be very important for farmers, on a case-by-case basis the council will be coming up with arguments that it will have to deal with about why consent terms should be longer and why also the word generally should be adopted so it's potentially longer than 15 years?
That's the situation that exists today with the premise under the RMA of 35 years. We have those conversations through a consenting process today. This direction gives a direction that you're not starting at 35, you're generally starting at 15 and then working your way back from that based on the particular circumstances. And so if there are particular circumstances that warrant a shorter duration, then those are the matters that you would consider when a consents officer makes a recommendation and ultimately the court makes its determination. As I said before, my support for this measure is that where the blanket 2035 was put in place, that for the very reasons that you've identified before, some people may go through their consent process in 2030 and then suddenly get no more than a 5-year consent duration because of the 2035. And it may well be that there's no alternative planning system in place for many years after that, and it seems a wholly unnecessary cost and burden to place on the regulated party through no fault of the regulated party. I think that 2035 went in there some years ago when maybe that was anticipated to be some 15 years post the expectation of when the plan was going to be operative. But it isn't operative. And so my recommendation is to put in place something that gives effect to that, which is generally no more than 15, and then let the process determine where it should go based on the merits of a particular proposal.
Thank you, I understand that answer. You would agree though, wouldn't you, that if the Regional Council is required to review consents within that period, or say, I'd use the terminology, ratchet back any consents because of issues that are identified during that period, that would be a very substantial administrative burden as well.
Absolutely. If there were a need to review, and as you clearly the legislation provides the opportunity for that to go for allocation limits or what have you, that places a burden on both the regulated party and the regulator.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Yes, you are. I have some questions here.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Mr. Sinclair. My name is Ms. Cedar Oak Airport for Fox New Zealand in this matter. I have very brief questions, you promise. Can I take you, please, to paragraph 29 of your evidence? 29 and 30 give example costs for controlled and restricted discretionary activities. The controlled is estimated at 1,500 excluding GST, and the restricted discretionary is estimated in excess of 3,000 excluding GST. Are you able to provide a ballpark for a discretionary activity cost?
Can I just those first 2 points to start with? There, I was very conscious about putting numbers in here because then my regulated parties looked to hold me to them. They weren't for the purpose of that. It was for the purpose of illustration of the of what the sort of costs may be. For those of you that are being involved with consent processes, $1,500 these days doesn't go very far. That's very much premised on a process that that has a very good application that's lodged. And of course, applications vary substantially. So the purpose was to try to identify differentiation. So getting on record, please don't hold me to those. Discretionary activity. It's the costs I see of the process are sometimes focused on council costs, but they, in my view, are often the smaller part of the cost of the process. It's the cost that a party needs to go to prepare their application. And so clearly a discretionary activity has far more things on the table than a controlled activity, and so the work that's going to be involved with a party to prepare their application would be more significant, clearly. At the end of the day, I have seen non-notified processes for relatively small activities cost many tens of thousands of council costs, and processes that you might see for very significant processes being relatively cheap, and very much that's determined on the quality of the application. So I know I've kind of avoided your question because I haven't got an answer for you in terms of a dollar figure, but inevitably the cost to an applicant will be greater, both in terms of the cost that they will pay their own advisors, but also the cost they'll pay council.
Thank you for highlighting the cost that they will pay for the application and for council. And I appreciate that that's very dependent on the circumstances in the application. So thank you for talking us through that. Look, I actually only have one question left. Could I take you to paragraph 43 of your evidence? You might not quite be the right person to ask this, but as I understand your role, I think you might have an answer for me. At 43A, you comment on the ability of the council to intervene in the farm environment plan process where appropriate, for example, to raise questions regarding the adequacy of mitigation measures. Are you confident that council staff would do this if they felt the need arose in the situation?
So I'm trying to think of a circumstance which will help answer that question. Perhaps let's think of the Whangamarino catchment. So it may be that upon advice from technical experts who help inform the consent process, that the FEP in isolation may not achieve the objectives of the plan in PC1 and particularly 2B5R, and therefore recommend additional conditions. That's the sort of example that I think I'm referring to here, where there are those high-risk catchments. As I said before, obviously freshwater farm plans and farm environment plans are more, they aren't as individualised for the particular risks that may appear in a particular catchment.
I guess I just wanted to highlight that there is the ability to do that adjustment.
Correct.
Excellent. Thank you very much. That actually answers all my questions.
Thank you. Mr. Ferguson, any questions for this witness?
Yes, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sinclair. A series of questions, and I acknowledge that you've been quite careful in marking out the matters upon which you've tried to focus your evidence and the matters upon which you've tried not to stray in regard to your current position relative to previous positions that might have helped. So if I'm straying in that regard, just let me know, although I think you have fairly tried to engage on some matters beyond that purview in answer to my friend's questions earlier. I just wanted to start with a point of clarification, and it arose from the exchange you had with my friend Ms. Omley regarding Policy 7 and the duration of consents of not more than 15 years. And you provided an explanation of where that had kind of come from. And I'm not sure if you were here on day one, but I think, I'm not quite sure where it was mentioned, but there was some discussion about the potential implications of the new Natural and Built Environments Act, and in particular the new provisions that have been inserted into Part 6 of Schedule 12 of the Resource Management Act. You are aware of those mechanisms?
Yes.
Now, as I read those, you sitting here today, the Council has to adhere to those obligations that are set out in that schedule, that Part 6 of Schedule 12, when dealing with an application for a resource consent that was made after the enactment of the new NVA, if we call it that, which I think was 24th of August or thereabouts. That relates to a water permit for an activity that takes use of dams or diverts fresh water, a discharge permit for an activity that's either a direct discharge or a diffuse discharge into water, and a land use consent as well, and for an activity that would otherwise contravene Section 15.1b by discharging a contaminant onto or into land in circumstances that may result in the contaminant entering fresh water. So we've got direct and diffuse discharges there. And we've got the usual dams, takes, uses, diverts, fresh water. So if one of those applications for resource consent is made now, and up until such time as we have a new natural and built environment plan in place and operative under the new legislation, my understanding is that these provisions that I think are in Clause 39 of Schedule 12 regarding duration of the consent apply to those affected consents. Is that correct? Is that your understanding?
Yeah, very much so. So in essence, if I paraphrase what you're saying...
probably much clearer than I just explained.
The government's legislation is more restrictive, and that would then apply.
And as I read that, what it says, and it's a little bit circular, but, well, not circular, but it's there, the consent authority may grant the affected resource consent for a fixed period or require that it expire by a fixed date, but in either case, the duration of the consent must not exceed 5 years after the date that the relevant rules have legal effect in accordance with Clause 6, Subclause 4 of Schedule 1 of the Natural and Built Environment Act, and that's the... That's essentially the new Natural and Built Environment Plan coming into effect, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
So regardless of whether you granted a consent for 15 years, if that 15 years took you beyond 5 years past the implementation operative date of a new NVE plan, then that's the cap. That's my reading, but anyway.
My reading is the same as yours, as the law is written today.
Yes, very wise caution.
And I think it's appropriate to, I don't say that in a joking manner, but I do, so that, I recognise that is, if I was giving advice it would be different, but that is the advice, that is the law of today.
Very good, and I think it's important to acknowledge that, views we might have of what the law should be, but what the law is, but this also, if we're looking at the time frame for developing that new plan under the new legislation plus 5 years, then we're going to be within that, likely highly likely within that 15-year period in any event, aren't they?
You said the law remains the way that it's written, and that has...
Let's progress on that.
It has significant implications for resource users in a region and across the country.
Yes.
Absolutely.
It's a sea change, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes. And I suppose in this region, we already had a sea change with the enactment and legislative recognition for Te Whanau. That's correct, isn't it?
If I can say, a very helpful additional enactment.
You can certainly say that. And I suppose that's why I wasn't troubled exactly, but I noticed that you commented, and again, this was your observation, having regard to the position of the regulator, as you put it, and the regulated, about that it's a lot easier if, you know, the rules are simpler and if there's kind of consistency across regions from those two perspectives, if you've only got one kind of set of things to have to grapple with. That was your kind of broad observation, wasn't it?
Yeah, as it relates to, I think that question was as it relates to the use of a tool around a gateway. But more broadly than that, as I said, the freshwater farmland regulations are looking to put a consistency around the country at a certain level, and then enabling communities to add to that as they see fit for their particular circumstances.
But it's quite fair here in the Waikato region, and certainly in relation to the Waikato and Waipa catchment, that the legislative framework demands a specific tailored approach that can go, and I would suggest should go, beyond what the national standard is. That's the imperative from the legislature.
Totally agree. And that's why I say the Te Whanau has been so helpful as interpreted by the court, because it raises a very simple question when one is making decisions, and that is this proposal going to make things better? It's a very, very large document, but it can be brought down to something quite simple, which is actually very helpful from an implementer's perspective, because you can articulate something simple. Is what you're looking to do going to make things better?
And that fundamental touchstone one has to come back to time and time again, which is, yes, there are challenges and issues for the regulator. Yes, there are challenges and issues for the regulator. Regulated, I would suggest there have been challenges and issues for tangata whenua going back to 1863 and beyond. But fundamentally, the touchstone here is the health and well-being of the old. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And so I think our council takes significant note that it was a joint, again, I'm straying a little, but I'm an executive, so I can't stray. It was a joint decision of the co-governance partners to propose this plan. And I think that it's the position of council to respect the joint position of the co-governance committee as it proposed this plan.
And I'd probably put it to you that it would go further than that, wouldn't it? Because I think in answer to your question, it may have just been a slip of tongue by you, but I thought I'd heard in an answer to an earlier question that you referred to the fact that the government has to give effect to Te Whanau, and therefore we have to do what we're doing. But it's actually the regional council that has to do with
that. So that wasn't the purpose of my comment, but the regional council certainly gives effect to Te Whanau, but the government put in place settlement legislation that was the formation of the Te Whanau. And so if the government was looking to amend, I think this was in answer to questions from the council from Fonterra, if the government was looking to amend the regulations, it would be hard to imagine how they would make amendments without which would compromise giving effect to the settlement legislation that they have promulgated as part of the Treaty of Waitangi settlement process.
I think it's a very reasonable observation to make. And obviously, with that context, so obviously the regional council has an obligation to give effect to 35 Mana through the development of PC1.
Absolutely.
And it would also be, you'd be well aware as an officer of council and in your regulatory role in terms of compliance, enforcement and other matters, that there's also a legal obligation within council in discharging and exercising its other functions under the Resource Management Act to have particular regard to 35 Mana. You're aware of that legal obligation?
Absolutely. It's the primary policy setting document.
That's right. And so it's not a question, is it, here if we get PC1 in place to give effect to the Whanganui Mana through that mechanism that everyone can then relax. There are ongoing active obligations to continue to reference to the Whanganui Mana, have particular regard to it, and even decisions about considering compliance or enforcement action. You acknowledge that?
Yeah, absolutely. For those that aren't within the Waikato region, we have joint management agreements. Joint management agreements identify how we will work together on a range of matters, including the matter that you've just mentioned.
You also made a comment, and I'm not sure whether it was really your comment or whether the phraseology was repeated in some questions about reference to holding the line. And really, we're not talking about holding the line, are we? We're talking about materially shifting the line, both in the short term, in terms of this consent, but longer term over the 80-year target of achieving to 35. That's correct?
Yes. So, again, that comment is about the gate, effectively the gateway test for that rule. Holding the line in terms of that rule doesn't mean that that's all you have to do. It's the gateway test. And then when one processes any consent application, once you're through that gateway test, the question is, what are you providing in terms of betterment to give effective vision and strategy to do fine?
So the gateway itself can't be set on a holding the line basis in any sense. It's actually, we're trying to shift.
Well, in that particular rule, the gateway test is around no. You're starting to get me to wander, but my understanding of the land use change rule is around no increase in footprint. Effectively, that's a kind of a non-technical term, no doubt. But that's just to get. When you process the application, clearly the obligations around 2.5 and around betterment are matters that come into play as part of the assessment process.
But again, I'm just concerned about testing this notion when you're linking or holding the line to that non-complying activity status, because as you would appreciate, any development of Tangata Whenua or ancestral land has to go through that gateway, doesn't it?
Oh, I see where you're going now. I've heard the questions around that, and I think it's probably better that I don't get into those merit arguments. I understand the argument around how does one create headroom to address historic inability to fully utilise resources. I understand that concept that's been presented, but I think that's probably a better policy merits question. I was just specifically mentioning that rule, and that rule covers any land use change which is going to increase that footprint. I'm not thinking about those certain changes in land use that increases footprint.
Yeah, my concern was, and I'm just trying to clarify you, and perhaps this is something, again, all roads seem to lead to Mr. Fidanko, or at least we're running out of witnesses other than him that might be able to deal with these residual matters. You'll be nervous next to me. But I just wanted to, that nobody was viewing that rule as somehow, the first and major step to achieving to 35 Mana was this shutdown, when we actually need to lower and create headroom, regardless of whether we've got development of Tangata Whenua ancestral land or not. We've got a shifting target over 80 years.
Oh, I think, yeah, absolutely agree with you. There's no doubt there's a long way to go.
Yeah.
And there's going to be many levers pulled along the way, and that particular rule was around one part of an overall political system to be able to achieve the two.
And when I come back to your talking about compliance, enforcement, etc., and I know you're very careful to say that enforcement is your kind of, I'm not sure it's a last resort, we wouldn't say that, but, at all, but it's part of a package of actions and interactions of the council with farmers and other users, that's correct.
Well, absolutely. When these rules eventually become operative, there are many thousands of resource users that these rules will relate to, and you have a greater wave of response as you make sure that your regulated party understands and moves their way through, and you'll use the full spectrum of compliance tools.
That's right. And putting to one side for the moment, if you can, issues of ease and practicality and cost. It's absolutely critical if we're trying to shift in that direction, and we have, as you've noted, a range of mechanisms, not simply a non-compliant activity status at the end, but we've got freshwater farm plans and a whole lot of other accounting and reporting that has to occur, that those things are critical to the effectiveness of monitoring, compliance, enforcement, and achieving those longer-term goals.
Absolutely. There is no point in writing rules if we don't ensure that people then comply with them. The tools that one brings out to move thousands of people in that positive direction are different at times, but it will be a critical element of success is our education, compliance and enforcement activities.
And therefore the detailed information that's in those freshwater farm plans is going to be a critical element and able to, for the council to be able to assess, and all of us to be able to assess, whether we are making progress against those longer term goals.
Yes, so obviously there's, I think, I'm not sure which witness mentioned this. The standards-based farm plans and then the objectives-based farm plans. It's the criticality of success, in particular for those farm plans and the freshwater farm plans under the regulations that go through a certification process, is the well-trusted certifier who is well-trained to be able to support the farmer to make good decisions around the actions. And we're investing significantly to be able to facilitate that process as best we can.
And there's essential data items that need to come back in from those farms in order to monitor and also to be able to make those overall assessments about improvement on a FMU or subcatchment level. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there was a question that was asking about the reporting of intensity within farms, and isn't that a really important matter? If we are not able to assess and monitor intensity within a farm unit, how do we have confidence in that? And I know the answer in part is, you know, these standards have to be met, but we also know the reality is why many people will, others won't.
I suppose that comes, at the risk of repeating myself, it comes to that question of proportionality around the intervention and where you are a D2 farm plan versus a D1 farm plan, if that's the right word, around the regularity of the reporting of information. Because all of those things come with a cost. And as both the regulations of PC1 mention, if you're compliant, the expectation on you would be every 3 years, I think it says. And so then the question becomes, is there this one element that is so critical that it should be reported on annually? Those are kind of policy merit type conversations around cost-benefit that I think would be, I invite you to, Mr. Terrell, to do these, and he no doubt will be thinking about them in anticipation of your question. I don't think it's fair for me to sort of comment on the policy merits without looking at the consequences.
No, and I was attempting to avoid doing that, and therefore was trying to steer away from cost-benefit type questions, but rather if you're not getting the information, how are you able to judge non-compliance and identify when it's occurring and take action?
So in that particular situation, when you say non-compliance, you mean that there is a larger number of animals. I think this is what you're saying, that if there were a larger number of animals rather than operating under a permitted activity regime, meeting all the obligations of a permitted activity, you'd go across into a consented regime. So you'd need to question whether is that the risk that you're saying is so great that it requires a greater regulatory intervention. Again, my view is you have the regulatory intervention is at the right level for the risk that you're looking to manage, and so if you believe that that is a risk that is of such significance, then I'd pose that question to Mr. Trebouka.
Thank you. I was just intrigued, I suppose, from a little bit of context, because you had referred to, and I know here you were talking about takes rather than discharges, but you referred in your rebuttal evidence, statement of rebuttal evidence, paragraph 12 through to 14, you were talking about variation 6. And you said in paragraph 12, at the time variation 6 was proceeding through its process, it emerged that there were a large number of farms taking water without necessary resource consent. Through the court hearing process, it became evident to the court that up to 3,000 such farms were likely to be taking water in excess of what was permitted under the regional plans that then stood. And that was obviously a grave concern.
I can put that a different way. At the risk of providing. So the regional plan had a limit of 15 cubic metres per day. That was when farms were a certain size. Farms grew. As farms grew, their demand, their water usage became a little bit more than 15 cubic a day. The court could have chosen to put the permitted activity level at 30, and it could have meant that those farmers were still mostly permitted. The court chose to leave it at 15, which meant there were a number of people that were taking an amount of water that was more than what the plan permitted. If you look at the totality of the water that is utilised in the region, that's not a huge amount of water. And so when you talk about it being of significant concerns in terms of the water being used, that's different than you have a situation where there are a large number of resource users that were legally unlawful, and the court provided helpfully a process for those farmers to become unlawful, because as you'll all be aware, the court effectively said they can have the water that they're using. They guaranteed them that water through a controlled activity rule, which effectively, in my mind, was the court saying, we're okay with you having that amount of water. After hearing the evidence from all the parties, you need to make sure they have their water lawfully. So a long answer to your question about whether or not that was of a significant concern, because it clearly wasn't of significant concern to the court, because the court effectively guaranteed all those parties that water.
Perhaps my view of what's a great concern is a different perspective from yours. But you then went on paragraph 14 to say that the industry and council identified the importance of working together to achieve two key objectives. This is after receiving the court's decision. That being that, quote, no farmer would miss out on what we described as their allocated volume of water. That was the scenario. That was the approach.
Yeah, very much so. So, because the court put a caveat on the water that they were making available to the farmer, that they lodged their consent application by a certain date. And at the time, there was a over-allocation status in the Waikato-Waikawa catchment, and so if a farmer didn't lodge by a certain date, they would lose that allocation. And that was not a tenable situation for anybody, and so that very much prompted the parties to get together to ensure that all farmers lodged their applications so that they could take advantage of the allocation that the court had made available to them through controlled activity status. I see similarities with the proposal here in that whilst people in this room will be very familiar with these rooms, I dare say there will be a very large number of farmers out there that are not, and that the only way that is a collective effort to ensure that those farmers are aware so they can ensure that they engage. And in that particular situation, the risks of failure to engage were significant. You cannot run your farm without water. So anyway, that's...
I wasn't really seeking to go into that level of explanation, but that's fine. It was more that in the context of Variation 6, and I'm thinking back to a hearing that I was in involving the Board of Inquiry into water care, and some questions that I was asking in the context of that inquiry of Cameron King of the Regional Council in relation to how many Section 128 reviews had been carried out since 2016, and I think that was we were in 2021, of water take consents, given us a broad range of reasons for a review, and his answer at that point was 3 to 4. So there'd be 3 to 4 reviews initiated under Section 128 of water take consents in the 7 years post Variation 6. And so it was that kind of figure that was echoing in my mind, and I know here we're talking about discharges, but what confidence have we got that the council, does the council accept that it's going to have to really gear up its monitoring, compliance and active engagement in relation to consents under PC1 and beyond?
Absolutely, we'll be needing to resource to be able to oversee compliance. The risk of wasting people's time, there are a number of levers that one can apply to achieve an outcome. You refer to review of several consents that would have reduced their water usage. There were equally a number of parties that amended their proposals, that surrendered applications, that sharpened their pencil, which collectively resulted in the situation that now we do not have an oversubscribed catchment of the Waikato and Waipa. So whilst I take your point that to achieve that objective, it may have only required a few consents to be reviewed, I can tell you that there is a lot of other activity that goes on to achieve those objectives, which is giving effect to Te Whaimana. We no longer have an over-allocated Waikato Waipa, and that's something to be celebrated.
Yes, we'll have an offline discussion about our respective views on that, which isn't relevant to the immediate matters we're talking about. Just one last question, and it was just in relation, going back to the non-compliant activity rule that you were talking about, essentially no conversions occurring, you weren't saying there were no actions being taken for breach of that non-compliant activity rule, since it's been notified, that's what you were saying, I think.
So correct, and of course you will be aware that there are parties that sought COCs, and therefore the rules of the plan don't apply, because they have, you understand what I'm saying?
Well, that's the exact point I wanted to be clear on, because one could take the sense from what you're saying, since 2016 there have been no conversions. And that's not the case at all, is it?
Of course that's not what I was saying, as you appreciate. Just so that it's clear, when parties went through that COC process, we were very clear that there will come a point in time that the regional plan is operative and that COC is no longer operative.
Do you have any idea about how many hectares have been converted into dairying since notification in 2016 under code of compliance?
Sorry.
Are you talking hundreds or thousands of hectares?
I really don't know. And I really couldn't even hazard to guess.
There have been some. I
know that COCs were sought and COCs were granted, as the law required them to. I don't know what exercise has occurred, because the ability to do something doesn't necessarily correlate to actually doing it. And so I don't have that information, sorry.
Thank you for that. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Mr. is not present. Mr. Pennell, are you there?
Yes, I am, Your Honour.
Do you have any questions?
I do have. The first one is, well, the first issue is the one I raised with Mr. Smith. And that's in relation to the farm planning regulations and controlled farming activities and the duplication that results from that. As I see it, both the certifier and the council have decision-making roles. Now, would you agree with that?
So, are you talking in terms of the regulations, Mr. Pennell?
Yes, the regulations overlapping PC1.
So, I think what Mr. Smith has attempted to do in the advice that he's provided to the court and to Mr. Kabilka is to try to get those aligned as best as possible. In terms of the regulations, councils are generally the administrators of the process. So Farmer works with trusted advisor, certifier, then certifies plan, certified, then tells council that the plan is certified. Then auditor audits the plan and then tells council the outcome of that. Council is the party that deals with non-compliance. We are the regulator. And so in that regard, decisions about whether or not the farm plan meets the regulations are down to the certifier. And comments from the auditor about whether or not the actions in that farm plan are to the auditor. But council is the regulator. For example, if a farmer doesn't engage with the system, we regulate around the engagement with the system. If a farm is identified to be not compliant with the farm plan, then council is the regulator. So if you're mentioning who's the decision maker, auditors, certifiers and council make decisions on different elements of the process.
Okay, I'm fairly interested in the process at the start where the certifier makes the decisions and approves or not the farm plan, and whether council then essentially, before giving consent, makes independent decisions over essentially the same matters as the certifier. Because in my amateur analysis of the matters, they seem to be coincident.
So, again, I'm starting to stray, but I'll stray temporarily, that if those that go through a consenting process have a certifier, will have a farm plan that will have a certifier, and I think it's the same question I mentioned, the comment I made earlier, that if a farm plan in isolation is not going to achieve the objectives of the plan, it's not going to address to 2-5 minute, then you may find that through a consent process there are additional obligations that are applied.
Would it not be more efficient for the council in its duties to train, to approve, to monitor the performance of certifiers, to ensure that compliance is done and checked off by the certifier rather than as an additional process by council?
So auditors will audit compliance, or audit whether or not actions have been completed. The council is the regulator as it relates to compliance with resource consents.
Okay.
So it's not a function. It's not that the council can't delegate its functions under compliance under the RMA to certifiers. So all the auditors. So the certifier, the auditor will be checking that the actions in the farm plan are complied with.
Yeah, look, I understand those secondary processes, the audit and the compliance and enforcement issues, but my concerns are around that first step of certification and consenting up front by the council before audit starts and before the compliance and enforcement actions start. The particular concern I have is that the decision maker needs to exercise considerable discretion, whether it's the certifier or the council, in approving a farm plan, just because of the very nature of the complexities involved, and that the regulations require a process of identifying inherent vulnerabilities, the risks of farming activities, and how those two mesh together to produce a list of actions in the farm plan. Because of that considerable discretion, if both the council and the certifier need to check off the same matters, it's very likely that each of those parties will come up with two different lists of actions, and that is something that of course you would appreciate that the farming community wouldn't welcome.
Yeah, I hear and understand the concern that you have, but I'm not seeing it in the way that the rules are framed. The way that I understand they're framed is that the farm plan certifies the farm plan. If it's required to be lodged as part of the consent application, it gets lodged as part of the consent application. The policy merits of that are for others to determine, but then when determining whether or not additional conditions are required to achieve the objectives of the policy and to define them in particular, the rule framework enables additional conditions on top of whatever outcomes would be achieved from the farm plan. I don't see the council reapproving the farm plan because the farm plan's already been approved. So whether or not there are additional requirements that need to be put in place.
Okay. You can see the potential problems arising in that situation, I'm sure, and how desirable it would be to have a one-stop shop in the essence, and that you have got ability through the CCCB process to front-load the requirements of what the certifier needs to be looking at and dealing with specific issues such as the Tongariro wetland.
Yes, I understand exactly the issue that you're saying, which comes back to the policy merits of moving between a permitted to a consented framework. And so the permitted framework is heavily reliant on the farm plan. The consented framework is where the risks are such that there may need to be additional measures, and that's a policy merits conversation, and I want to steer away from that.
Okay, thank you. Can we, my next couple of things are to do with efficiency of the process, but you may make the same comment if just might. gateway rules for dairy and dry stock. I understand one of the reasons before the farm plan regulations came out was for to enable council to have a greater level of scrutiny for higher activities and therefore require controlled activities. The regulations now provide for any activity status in various ways much greater scrutiny of council. Now, just following on and making the distinction between dairy and dry stock, dairy has a standard of a controlled activity requiring a reduction in the NRS score if you're in the controlled activity consent process, whereas dry stock has no similar standard. So it seems to me that the justification for having two activity classes for dry stock, given the presence of the farm planning regulations, is now very quite vacuous.
Can I just jump in for timing? You are 100% right. I'm not going to be answering questions about those policy merits because those are questions for Mr. Trebilco. My evidence is simply that the policy merit should create a pathway which is the least onerous so that it's simpler for implementation, and I don't make any further comments on the policy merits.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Trevorrow is the one for right, my last line of questions are optionality of schedules D1 and D2. Currently, they're tagged to permitted and controlled. Use D1 for permitted, D2 for control, or higher consent. I cast my mind to other regulatory regimes, and where often there's the option given for the party to exercise one or two approaches. One, a high level principles based provision that offers flexibility, but is often much more complex to implement. I'll put Schedule D in that category. The other option is a standards based approach that is simple to apply but lacks flexibility. Schedule D1 approach. And layer options that can be exercised by the regulated party. I'm wondering, for efficiency reasons, whether that same optionality could be provided for permitted consent of activities.
So again, I think Mr. Trevorrow has heard the question. It's a policy merits conversation. My understanding was to provide a staggered approach. A permitted activity rule had a standards-based approach, and a consent activity had the objectives-based approach. I understand your question. It's a question for Mr. Trevorrow.
Okay. Thank you. That's the end of my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pinnell. Any re-examination? Any questions?
Perhaps just very quickly, Mr. Ferguson himself asked the questions relevant to my issue, but it's just around Rule 3.11.4.9, which is what I think you've called the holding the line rule. And I think when you talked about that rule in response to Ms. Carruthers, you suggested that there would be a long road to hoe for anyone seeking a change in consent use. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. So I suppose really the question is, how then do you envisage giving effect to Objective 4 of Plan Change 1 if the line makes effect to hold the line as opposed to give effect to it?
At the risk of not answering your question either, so I'm just trying to describe my understanding of the policy merit, and the policy merit in that situation, as I understand it, was whilst the plan is going through its process to put a line to say, land use change needs to get past a test of no greater footprint. Where that ends up, I guess, is the purview of the court, but because that rule had effect from the date of notification, it was an opportunity to not see proliferation of land use change whilst this process has been underway. And so that's why I describe it as a hold the line. So we have had applications launched seeking land use change, and those that have lodged those applications would have received quite significant requests for information from our staff saying, how are you going to be ensuring that you the information to support no increase in footprint? So that's why I say it's been a hold the line rule.
Yeah, and I think you responded in that way with Mr. Ferguson, although you weren't able to give him many numbers on those changes. I suppose objective four really relates to tangata whenua, use of change of consent. So you're not able to advance beyond what you've just said. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not, but I understand the issue, and I understand that it will be a matter for the policy advisers to articulate how one might do that. But as you'll appreciate, the current rule has the effect that I think they've described, that it impacts on any party, including Thomas.
Right, thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Your Honour. And I have no questions either. Anything arising out of his honest questions? No. Thank you, Mr. Sinclair.
Thank you.
Good time. All right, well, I don't think we'll start another witness this evening. 9:30 tomorrow is still convenient for everyone. Very good. I think we're moving to your economists now.
Yes, that's right, Your Honour.
Mr. Trevilco.
That's correct. And the only question I had in terms of that overall timing is, I know you mentioned earlier today, I think you were making inquiries in terms of Ms. Toomai's witnesses, whether any witnesses might be able to be heard remotely in Hamilton, and I guess for our decision making as to how we structure the rest of this week, if there is any update on that.
Yeah, we'll do that. I'll need to discuss that with the registrar and we'll see where we go.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.